Welcome to Circular Firing Squad. I'm Marty Gentius, a counseling faculty member at Kent State University and host for Circular Firing Squad. We've got four members, four questions, and four answers to each question. Questions are generated by each squad member and run from the thoughtful to the trivial. I've got the four female members of our squad. The other two male members are out. Eric has been corralled into a kid's Halloween party, so you kind of know where, I think, where he'd rather be. He said, I'm going to see if, you know, my wife gets bored with me there and says I can leave and go home. I might make it into the show in time. And Elliot is doing a tech run through for a show I think he's playing bass in. There's some theater show. So that's what I assume where he's at. So let's hear from who's here tonight.
Hey, everyone. Jen Cook, Associate Professor, New England College.
Hi, everyone. Gina Martin, Assistant Professor at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater.
Hello, Stephanie Martyr, Practicing Clinical Counselor, Doctoral Candidate at Kent State University and co-host of Grad School Deconstructed.
So, Jen, you've got the first question.
All righty, I'm up first tonight. I haven't been first in a while, but I also don't think I've been on in a while, so it's good to see everybody. So we're in this very peculiar time of year, and the question that came to mind to ask you all, I say it's a peculiar time of year because we're in fall, but there's something about the adverts on the radio and on TV and the merchandise that seems to be entering the stores for about the last 6 weeks that makes me think that we're already in the winter holiday season. So I'm curious, when do you all think it's appropriate to start the winter holiday season in terms of merchandising and movies and music? When can the winter holidays begin?
I love this, Jen. Kind of commenting on Eric's situation right now, I am having a Halloween party for a bunch of littles in about a week from tomorrow. And so I went to Target the other day and I just wanted to look for some Halloween things to maybe, you know, decorate some cookies and have a little gift bags for all these little kids from the neighborhood that are going to be coming over to my house. And I ended up buying all Christmas stuff because there was nothing left for Halloween. And I was like, I think we've skipped over this holiday and maybe I just haven't been to Target in a while, but I didn't have anything for Halloween and I couldn't find anything for Halloween. There were like three pumpkins that said trick or treat, but like the trick had been like smudged off and were like dented. So I was like, you know what? We'll just run with it. So I got some Christmas pillows and I got some holiday dish towels. I don't know, very boring things that my husband was like, what are you thinking? And where's everything for this Halloween party that we're supposed to be hosting? And so, yeah, I don't think it's appropriate. I think that I would have rather waited until after Halloween. And it's the only thing that's available right now. I just don't understand where everything has gone.
Gina, don't you know that's where it starts? It's people like you who buy that stuff early and it just gets earlier and earlier.
Well, and that's part of the problem, isn't it? Because I waited too long on Halloween, and now I'm going to have approximately three cookies for the 15 children that are coming.
But how'd you wait too long? I mean, Halloween isn't for another week, right? I mean, my calendar says that it's a week away. So I don't know. Like, were you there, like, you know, in a week's time? That would be too late.
Right. I didn't even think I was waiting until the last minute. I thought I had plenty of time. This was even yesterday. So I had over a week.
You're not too late. The stores are understocked and they want to start pushing the next. They want to say you're too late. They say you're too late by not having merchandise. But
well, I panicked and bought everything for the next holiday. So
it's a big mind game. I don't know. Like, so here's where you had to. I'm sorry. Were you done? Because I was going to say where you had to.
Yeah,
the Halloween candy, because what I noticed was the end of July is when in the grocery stores start. So when you plan for Halloween, oh, Marty's ready.
Marty is ready.
We're all going to my candy to get drawer our, in my office.
Our Halloween candy. And speaking of Halloween candy, I really wish they knew, like the Snickers company, they need to know. We absolutely are quite aware that you overload the Three Musketeers in the packages. Can you stop? Like, give us four more Snickers, three more Twix, maybe another Milky Way, but we don't need all Three Musketeers. You're just unloading them on people and getting annoying. Yeah, I think I like the good old days where it felt like it was too early when Christmas and the winter holiday stuff started at Thanksgiving or right after Thanksgiving. That's when it used to be. You used to hear not a peep so much. And then, I mean, I feel like I have grown up and my lifetime has kind of witnessed the regression of the starting of the holidays all around. And it's just earlier and earlier. And it's weird. It's like, when are we? I don't know. What month is it? It just doesn't make sense. It's all mushed together and it's confusing. And so I would say Thanksgiving, right after Thanksgiving, is when it would be appropriate at this point. Anything before that, inappropriate, and it should stop.
Okay, so just a quick question here. Did you buy Halloween candy at the right after the 4th of July?
No, I was appalled.
Okay, I was just curious because I don't eat sugar. I think I've said that on the show before, but I can hazard a guess that like if I had a bag of like Snickers / Milky Way / apparently more Three Musketeers, they making it past like the 10th of July, much less making it to the 30th of October.
Right?
So,
mm-hmm.
And who wants to eat some 3 month old chocolate anyway? I mean, I know you pawn it off on the neighbor kids, but they don't want to eat it then either.
Okay, this is terrifying because the fact that I can't even get Halloween decorations and things for a party, I'm going to be handing out pretzels at this rate.
Go to Walgreens. They always have bags of candy.
So, you know, Aileen accuses me of having conversations with people who are not there. And we were driving down the main street of Kent, the cobblestone sort of street of Kent, where the bars are. And I noticed that the lampposts had Christmas wreaths on them already. And so, you know, being born and raised in Chicago, I like to talk to other drivers. And apparently I like to talk to imaginary people. And I said, you know, I should write a letter to the newspaper and complain about that these things are up so early. But then someone will say, oh, you should have Christmas in your heart the whole year round. And Aileen said, who are you having this conversation with? Because it's not me. That was the shock that I found a couple of days ago driving through Kent, that the Christmas decorations are already up. And I thought, well, maybe they're evil Christmas decorations. Maybe they're supposed to be Halloween decorations and they're evil wreaths and evil garland that are going to strangle little kids. There's got to be something, but the idea that all of these holidays are colliding and you don't see much Thanksgiving stuff out. I have a neighbor right next door to me who pretty much does everything for every holiday. So, but she's timed it appropriately. She's still on Thanksgiving. She's still on Halloween. And then we'll be moving to Thanksgiving within the next week, I'm sure. But no Christmas stuff. We're not going to see that for a while. So when's the appropriate time? Yeah, it's up to the holiday, then you can start celebrating another holiday. I'm sorry if that sounds curmudgeon-y.
Well, then I'm curmudgeon-y too, because I personally am thinking like, I need to get my pumpkins done and my ghosts put away before I start thinking about Thanksgiving and, you know, Christmas holiday. For my family, we celebrate Christmas. So why are we doing this so early? And the fact of the matter is they all do start to blend together. And frankly, it's like, I feel like you can't even enjoy the holiday that you're on because of it. And furthermore, I remember like things waiting until later when we were growing up. Like I remember that Thanksgiving Day was when the Christmas music would start on the radio. And I understand, like, we're in a very different era now with radio listening and all that kind of stuff. But by the same token, like, I appreciated that. And it was like you felt the marking of the holidays, of that type of the winter holiday season. So yeah, I'm a curmudgeon as well. I'm like, can we just take it one day at a time? Because I was seeing the bulbs and whatnot coming out in big lots. They were clearing out all of the summer stuff. And maybe this is regional because, you know, winter starts in September, I guess. But I don't know. I wasn't ready to see the Christmas trees popping up in September. I'm just not there yet.
So for our next question, we're going to switch gears a little bit. So speaking of seasons, for us at Whitewater, we are in the season of admitting new students. And so I am curious, how do you figure out if a new student is going to be a good fit for your program? What do you look for?
All right. So this is a little difficult because I haven't really analyzed students in that kind of way in selecting them for a program. However, you know, I had to go through the process as a student. And I think as most of us are in programs, especially that we might sometimes compare ourselves to others. So I would have a list of kind of what I was looking at from others. And maybe if it's, ooh, they're better than me on that, or they have that over me, whatever it is. Or just like, oh, I noticed that quality. So I think that there's probably elements of, you know, understanding the profession to a degree. Having a vocabulary where you can discuss all of the necessary topics with the, you know, using the right terms and keep up with that kind of conversation. Probably if they don't talk about themselves constantly and how great they are, I think, it's okay to talk about your accomplishments, but I think sometimes you can kind of get a sense too, if they're on that other end where maybe they really know all of their stuff, but there might be some personality traits that might just not be the right fit for the program that they're looking for. So I think it's a matter of kind of some confidence, knowing what they're doing or knowing who they are and why they want to be in that program or at least in that profession. And then maybe an element of being humble too and being open to learning.
I say this tongue in cheek, but it plays out more than I would admit it. A undergraduate psychology degree will ruin your ability to be relational with anybody. Steph is giving me a really dirty look. You're an exception. You are a relational person, but I'll tell you, sometimes I'd rather have a theater major than a psychology major. Because they know the fine art of connecting with people. So for me, how do I know a good student? It's really relational. They're meeting me for the first time, like they would meet a client for the first time. And in that sense, I want to know how they connect with me. And I'm going to pay attention to that. Probably the second most, maybe the first most important piece, which is really hard to assess when you're meeting somebody, is ambiguity tolerance. If a student can't handle ambiguity, they are, one, going to have a difficult time with the program, and two, also have a difficult time being a counselor, because that's all we deal with is ambiguity. How do I assess for that? That's really hard to assess for, but you didn't ask me how I came to these conclusions. You just asked me what I thought were the important ways of deciding what's going to be a good student.
Well, I'm in application season all the time because we interview every 2 weeks in my program. So this is something I do frequently. And I would say when it comes to, this is important on the paper application. We do two assessments. One is on the paper and then one is in the interview. And I think with both of them, like I want to hear real, like sort of what Marty's saying with the relational. But in the interview piece, I want to see some of Roger's core conditions. Like, are you warm? Do you seem to have some empathy about you? Can you connect? You know, like those are the types of things that I want to fill and I want to sense in the room. On paper and in the interview, I want to hear the reason why you want to be a counselor. Like, I don't think I can be any more clear about this, but like, if you're applying to a counseling program, you should probably say why you want to be a counselor. And when you're asked the question again in an interview, you should be able to articulate why you want to be a counselor. Like, it is remarkable to me the number of people who will sit through an interview and never say why they want to be a counselor. I'm like, where do you think you are? Even if they use a term that I don't prefer for our profession, which is therapist, because that's not, we've been through this on the show before, so I won't get on that soapbox. At least you're in the neighborhood of talking about the professional helping relationship. But those are things that I'm looking for usually. And I want to see a real person. I want that genuineness to come through. Because if it's fake, if people are just sort of saying which they want to hear, which they think you want to hear, psychology majors, it's really hard to get a feel for who are you going to be in the room? Because my guess is that the ambiguity tolerance is going to be really hard. The, you know, ability to be flexible and adaptable, those are typically really hard. Like when we get people who are very by the book and like they're kind of giving it to you by the book, I don't know how else to say it. You're like, wow, you know a lot of stuff. Good on you. And I'm not quite sure how this is going to go for you. Like you're going to have a hard couple of years until you like loosen up a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that those are really great responses and I appreciate those. And I really appreciate the psychology major tidbit.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, there's not. And when I was in college, I wished I was a psychology major. I was an English major. And I think that that has served me well in this role for a number of different reasons. Not only that relational, the ambiguity tolerance, right? Who gets frustrated at the end of a book when you don't really know what happens? That's ambiguity, right? And I love it, which is why I love this field too. And I think that that's an important quality, like all of you have kind of alluded to. So for me, I agree with all of that. I think it's all about the connection that people build with you. Cause like Marty said, you're meeting someone for the very first time. We also do it, two different ways. We have the written component and then the interview component as well. And you can kind of tell from some of the written material, but you can really tell when you're face to face with someone, if they're able to connect with you or if they're able to bring that genuineness, whatever. It's my new word. So you got to bring that genuinity, that authenticity and genuineness combined into one. And that's something that I think is so crucial to being a counselor, paired with that warmth and all of that good stuff that, you know, they all talk about. So anyway, those are some things. And then additionally, do you check your email? It kind of helps in a master's program to be able to check your email. So it's another core component that I look for.
Wait, I just got to check. So 3 out of the 4 of us did not have undergraduate majors in psychology. Is that right?
I had a double minor in psych and bio.
Oh, so you had
and actually my master's is in counseling psychology.
No way.
Yes, I know. I'm the evil dark side.
Well, one of my masters is counseling psychology and counselor education. So I lived on the edge of both. But no, my undergrad was religion and philosophy double major. So I'm out there.
I guess I'm on the edge too. Like, what does it mean if you have a master's in psychology and in counseling? I know, right? Am I just like some weird thing? All right. I'm glad.
There's others like you, Steph. Don't worry. There's others like you.
I feel like I didn't realize this was such a thing. I didn't realize there was such a pigeonhole. I mean, I know there was, but not like, I don't know. I think I just experienced it so completely. Started to feel self-conscious about my education.
Don't worry. We won't ask again. We won't ever say anything bad about a psychology major ever again.
You can't.
Hey, they
go
do
ahead.
Great. They do great in the diagnosis course and in the psychopath course. I'll give them that.
Well, I'll say this, though. In the undergrad curriculum, my two favorite courses, it was abnormal psychology and counseling psychology. And those are the ones where I really retained the information and I just like couldn't wait to get to class and I found stuff interesting, but those were the two that stuck out. So maybe there's a little bit in there. Moving on, we're going to go and take a turn. All right. I'm going back to an old question that I don't think ever got asked. And I can still remember what was playing when I thought of this question. Have you started to notice songs which defined your youth suddenly being used to sell things like arthritis medication, heart medication, things marketed for people of a certain age?
I notice songs from the time that I was youthful being used, but not songs from my youth. The songs I listened to in my youth, they're not using. They're using those happy, pappy, zappy pop songs for arthritis medication and diabetes medication. Some of the songs are actually commercials for medication I take. So, but they weren't songs that I listened to or cared for. They just happened to coincide with that time in my life. And frankly, I don't think there was anybody who listened to or cared for those songs. They were just popular.
Well, I'm thinking that the ones from my youthfulhood, something, not childhood, although there's one with Animal from from Sesame Street, which is, and he's sort of doing it, meh, 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 you know, as opposed to singing. But apparently our generational music likes to sell insurance because, like, for example, like, you know, we have a rat problem. I don't know if anybody's seen that one for Geico. I think it's Geico. And, you know, the band Rat is upstairs. And then Axl Rose showed up. No, not Axl. Slash from Guns N' Roses showed up on a commercial, I think, again, for insurance the other night. So apparently there's something with, like, my generation of music, like 80s and 90s, that apparently we need a lot of insurance right now. I mean, I don't know what that's about. Maybe we 40, 50 year olds are dangerous people who need insurance. And ironically, most of it's car insurance. So I'm going to have to laugh about that because most places, you know, you kind of have to have that. So, but I haven't gotten any like arthritis medication or, you know, the one that sticks in my head is not even a real song. It's just like the one for, I'm on a tangent, but because these things stick in my head of the one that's like this Japanese like pain cream and it's like, send me to, which is the name of the company. And like that gets stuck in my head from all those commercials out of all of them. So anyway, I'm on a tangent. Cut all of that, Marty. Like, that's terrible.
Of course, I'm not going to cut that.
Look, everyone already thinks I'm a lunatic. So go ahead and just leave it in.
So I'm also totally lost because I don't really watch TV ever. So I don't really watch commercials, therefore. And when we do watch TV, it's, I don't watch TV. Yes. No, I watch shows though, but there's never commercials. So I'm just never exposed to commercials. And when I do watch the shows, the only thing that ever comes up are those Progressive commercials. We get like the same, you know, the same like two or three commercials over and over and over and over and over again. And not a lot of them have music. But the Progressive commercials where they show like becoming your parents. Has anyone ever seen those?
I love those. They're wonderful.
I love them. My husband and I have looked them up outside of watching commercials so that we could watch them all.
There's more?
There's more. And there's like ages, like years of them. And I just find so much connection to them because there's so much truth. And I just think it's great. My favorite one is when they see someone walking by with blue hair and the guy is like, don't comment. And the other guy's like, blue.
No, see, my favorite one is when they're in the airport gift shop and the wife is like, don't worry, honey, don't get that. I brought snacks.
Yep.
Because that's totally me. I'm always bringing my snacks on the plane.
Always, always. It's just so great. And there's just so much truth. And I'm pretty sure that my parents have said some of the things on the commercials and they just bring me a lot of joy. So not really music, but something that really resonates with my upbringing, I suppose.
I love that because There is so much. You're right. There's so much joy in those commercials. I get excited when I see a new one. I think I looked the actor up, the one, but like they all of them just have something extra, like at the end where they get so like, oh, I can't believe you're throwing my sign away. Like,
yes, family rules.
So for me, it really hit hard when I believe one of the arthritis medications was using a Supergrass song to advertise. And to me, Supergrass is a band that I really enjoy. I think they're creative. I think there's more to them. I kind of know what Marty is saying, because I remember, you know, I think there are some songs that are just kind of like, for a long time, you're like, eh, okay. You know, and you just knew them because they were overused and overplayed and for commercials and all the parodies and stuff. They were just using Supergrass. And I was just like, damn, like we're in that age. I don't know. There it is.
I've got a question that shifts back a little bit about change. One of the things I've noticed since the semester has started, and at least at my institution, people are coming back, that programs are changing constantly, and you might find this too. How do you deal with organizational change? How do you kind of personally put yourself together to deal with organizational change?
Well, I guess it depends on what it is and who it is, because I think we all of us who are in academia, there's always somebody shifting somewhere. And if it's, you know, within the department, that can have one effect. If it's within the next level, which in my current institution is the division, or it would have been the college at my last shop, you know, if it's above that, you know, are we going to, you know, how is it going to affect me? And usually the further it gets from me, the less impact it has on my day to day. Although some structural changes have a lot of impact. So they just restructured at my shop, and I'm still not sure who does what or who reports to whom, to be completely honest. And sometimes that's a little bit discombobulating, just because you're like, wait, who's writing me for what reason? And like, what's their role? And, you know, but I think for me, I've gone through, and, you know, not nearly as many years of changes as you've been through, Marty, but I think so much of academia is a lot of slow change, and then a lot of quick change, and then a lot of slow change, and a lot of quick change. It's like, it's this very strange dichotomy, and it's happening all the time. It's like, oh, if you don't like it, just wait a minute, it'll change. Or if you like it, just wait a minute and it'll change. You know, I think that there's a lot of that. So I would say we were talking about ambiguity tolerance. I think that counselor attribute is typically pretty helpful for me. Like, I have it in spades most of the time. I don't know. I kind of flow with it to the best of my ability, especially when it doesn't impact my day to day. And when it starts impacting the day to day, then it's like, okay, well, what am I going to do about this? How do I want to manage it? But by and large, a lot of the institutional changes, like, they just get called down. And what can you do? Most of the time, we don't even have any power over it. So it's like, well, you can either hang with it, or you can go somewhere else, or you can try to change it, or, you know. And most of the time, us peons, you know, we don't have any power to change it if it's any higher than the department. So it's like, well, who wants to fight that battle? I got shit to do. So, you know, let's just get back to our regularly scheduled program, which is, you know, the slew of videos I have to watch and the papers I have to grade and the emails that need responding, you know?
Yeah, for me, I think it depends, too. And I think this is coming at an interesting point in my career, because I've been in one place for not too long. And then before that, my life was constantly changing, right? There was a lot of change with not only with COVID, but with being a PhD student and then, you know, that type of job, and then moving on to something different. And so I feel like I just came out of a constant state of change where that ambiguity tolerance was key. And now that I'm in something that's a little bit more stable and a little bit more, you know, long-term feeling, it's more of, well, if it's within my department, maybe that brings a little bit of anxiety, like, oh gosh, how am I going to handle this? What's going to change? How is that going to affect my day-to-day? And if it's above that, which our institution has experienced a lot of change in the past year and a half now that I've been there, and it hasn't really affected me in my day-to-day. And I think you just kind of take it in stride, like Jen said, and you do what you can about it. And you, you know, have conversations with people, you understand the overall culture and all that stuff. And then you just do what you can and keep on keeping on.
You know, I agree with what you were saying, both of you, just when it doesn't really affect you, you just go with it. I think it depends on how much effort it takes to go along with the change that they're making and how much capacity I have in my reservoir to put energy into learning how to make the change or putting the effort into making the change. Sometimes there's just something small, more, you know, just, you know, it can be the hardest thing to put the email in this folder going. And I'm like, I've never done that. And now I have to remember, we're still in the change period. I can get away without doing it for another week. Right. Like sometimes it's just like, it's difficult, but then once I do it, it's like usually pretty easy to keep doing it. It's just that first time. I know that's not necessarily the same as a big organizational change, but sometimes at our practice, they change the electronic database system. And, you know, there was a crossover period, and it just, I don't know, I kind of extended it longer than I needed to, but it was also like, I just want to do my work and get my notes done and be done. But it took a little while, but sometimes if I'm like into it and there's nothing else going on, I'm like, cool, let me learn this right now and understand it. And, you know, everyone else is kind of like, do you know we have to do this? I'm like, yeah, it's just this boop, 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 boop. And it's done. So it just depends on where I am and how much energy I think I also have into learning and figuring it out.
All good responses. I asked this question because coming back, and again, we're more in the building now. And because of that, we're having more meetings. And of course, the administration are coming up with new and wonderful ways to change things around campus. I look around and see some of my younger colleagues and sit in these meetings with our school chair, and they just look exhausted with the amount of change they're trying to wrestle with. And at my point in my career, I feel, let me tell you, it's great once you get to that point in your career, because I literally said to a colleague, I can stand on my head on broken glass until I retire. I mean, it's not that, but you're going to be here probably for years beyond that. So, any change that happens, I only have to live with for a much shorter period of time. I'm also reminded by a colleague that has since retired. Deans come and go, and we had a new dean coming in, and he said, you know, and I was like, this guy is falling. This guy, we got a new dean, you know. And he's like, you know, you got to realize this is often a stepping stone for them to a vice provost position. And his philosophy was, I'm going to be here a lot longer doing what I'm doing than you're going to be dean in my college. So good luck. You know, whatever change you make or whatever you do, you'll be on in a couple of years. So, you know, that's the reality of it. So I've gotten a little bit more inoculated to concerns about change and how that's impacted. So just thoughtful because, you'll always hear those voices that'll come from your institution about the next change that's coming down the road, and whether it materializes or not, just trying to keep it in perspective. So that's it for all the questions tonight. I have one final shot question. What's your favorite Thanksgiving side? Jen is speechless.
Well, I had to process a side for a second. For some reason, what popped in my head was side piece, as opposed to like a side, like on the side of your turkey. I don't know why. I just watched a 17-year-old boys play hockey, so maybe that's why, the violence of it all. I this is really weird. I love creamed onions. Does anybody know what creamed onions are? They're like the shiznit, as far as I'm concerned, of side dishes, and do not show up on everyone's table. But I do like my mom's sweet potato, whatever. I'm not going to say more. I'll just leave it at the onions. But like, I love the sides at Thanksgiving.
I too am a big side fan. And my favorite, this might be an unpopular opinion, Brussels sprouts with chestnuts.
Never had them with chestnuts. Usually I bacon up those things.
Chestnuts and pancetta.
Oh, okay. There's the bacon.
Adding to it. Yes.
There you go.
Okay. She's Italian. It's pancetta, hon.
That's right.
I apologize. I like the green bean. I also actually eat almost exclusively sides at Thanksgiving. I might have one piece of turkey symbolically. The green bean casserole, but I like it just the completely generic Campbell's mushroom soup and like the French's fried onions. I want it just like that.
Cafeteria style.
We double up the French's fried onions and don't tell anybody because that's the best part. Mine has got to be turkey dressing or stuffing, if you want to call it that. Nothing fancy, but lots of celery in it and just smothered in gravy. So it's almost like a pudding, a stuffing pudding with gravy. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks to the squad, Jen, Gina, and Stephanie. Look for some of these characters on their podcasts on thepodtalk.net. You can find out more about them at circularfiringsquad.net. Our theme music is from Menage a Quad, Real Swing Shet. That's it for this episode of Circular Firing Squad. Ready, fire, aim.